that kind of stuff, but I just hope that you understand the purpose for it. I and the elders have used the results of the last survey that we did as a way to steer you over the last two and a half years, rejoicing in the strengths that it showed and trying to strengthen any weaknesses which we may not have even known unless you had told us. And so please help me lead you well. Help us lead you well. Help us help you become the Christians that God would want you to be. You can do that just in 15 minutes by going on that link and filling out the survey so that we can know where you're at and pastor and lead aptly because of that. Okay? In terms of the prayer emphasis, it is one of the results of the Reveal survey. We saw that we were weaker than others in prayer, so we wanted to strengthen that. And I would like you to do something for me this morning, and it's not anything that's going to cost you much except maybe a little bit of pen ink, and that's to flip two reading dates around. January 25th and February 1st, I'd like you to switch them, okay? Well, it'll be done on the web and all that kind of stuff, but if you're following a paper copy, just switch those two dates. And the reason is that the topic listed for January 25th is the elder prayer for healing. But we're not going to be having the elder prayer for healing that day, but we are going to be having it, as we always do, following the communion service on February 1st. And so that topic will be dealt with on a day in which we can actually follow up with it after communion. So switch those two around, the 25th and Feb 1. I'll send a note to the home groups, I'll send a note to the men's and women's groups, but if you can just do it yourself, that would be helpful as well. And one of the most painful experiences that we can encounter in life, and which Steve alluded to a little bit, is being attacked or betrayed by someone you love. Someone that you thought was a friend, one whom you have cared about, poured your life into, perhaps even given your heart unstintingly to. I mentioned before a book by a great theologian and thinker of our day named Miroslav Volf in past, entitled Exclusion and Embrace. In it, he records the first person story of a woman in Eastern Europe. And she says this: I'm a Muslim. I'm 35 years old. To my second son, I gave the name Jihad so that he would not forget the testament of his mother. Revenge. The first time I put my baby to my breast, I told him, may this milk choke you if you forget. She said, the Serbs taught me how to hate. And she goes on and she describes her work as a teacher and how the very students that she taught became her enemies. She said, my student Zoran, the only son of my neighbor, urinated into my mouth as the bearded hooligans stood around and laughing. He told me, you are good for nothing else, you stinking Muslim woman. She taught him school. She took the knowledge from her mind and put it into his. She took the love from her heart and expressed it to him. And she was cruelly attacked and betrayed in turn. It's hard to imagine what she must have felt. For there is no pain like the pain of betrayal and attack from friends and family. Times like this, times of betrayal and attack, can humiliate you and tear your heart apart. They can even destroy your faith. They can drive you to despair, to want to bail out or boil over. On the other hand, they just might drive you to your knees. But what then? After all, what do you say? How do you pray when you are attacked? How do you pray when you are betrayed? How ought one to pray in a situation like that? Well, I believe that Psalm 55 gives us an attack, a prayer for those who are attacked and betrayed. And it contains three component parts that we're going to look at in a while, okay? But in order to get the power of the psalm, the power of the prayer, it's important to understand the context that went behind the prayer. What caused David to pray the way that he did? Scholars feel that David wrote this prayer, this psalm, during the events that happened historically and are recorded in 2 Samuel chapters 15 and 16, which I want to take about 10 minutes to look at first if you want to look there. In brief, David's second oldest son, Absalom, was attempting to win the hearts of the Jewish people away from his father in order to gain the kingdom for himself. And it was working. He did it a number of ways. The first way that he won the hearts of the people away from the king and towards himself was to imitate or play the part of a king. 2 Samuel chapter 15 verse 1 says that he provided for himself a chariot and horses and 50 men as runners before him. You can understand what the role of the horses and the chariot were, but the role of the runner would be to run ahead and to alert all to Absalom's approach so that they would leave their beds and businesses and breakfasts and go outside and see Absalom, who, according to the biblical record, was a magnificent human specimen, riding in a chariot pulled by horses that was always a symbol of military or political wealth and power. He was imitating a king as he tried to usurp his father's throne. The second thing that he did was he gave favorable judgments to those who came to Jerusalem in order to seek a time with King David, in order to seek an audience with him. Verse 2 says that Absalom used to rise early and stand beside the gate. And when a man had a lawsuit and came to the king for judgment, Absalom would say to him, "From what city are you?" The man would respond, "Your servant is from one of the tribes of Israel." Then Absalom would say to him, "See, your claims are good and right, but no one listens to you on the part of the king." Moreover, Absalom would say, perhaps in a pining manner, "Oh, that one would appoint me as a judge over the land. Then every man who has any lawsuit or cause would come before me, and I would give him justice." And when the man would come near and prostrate himself before Absalom, he would put out his hands and take him and kiss him, which wouldn't do anything for me wanting for him to become king, I'll tell you that. You kiss me, you go to the salt mines. You don't, you become king. But it worked in that culture, because verse 6 concludes this progression by saying, "In this manner, Absalom dealt with all of Israel that came to get judgment by the king. And so Absalom stole away the hearts of the men of Israel, presumably from his father." So he was admirable. He was available. He was amiable. A perfect imposter king. The result is that in chapter 15, verse 13, one of David's servants came to him and said, "The hearts of the men of Israel are with Absalom." And David, who was suddenly and understandably afraid, said to his servants who were with him in Jerusalem, "Arise, let each of us flee, for otherwise none of us will escape from Absalom. Go in haste, lest he overtake and quickly and bring down calamity on us and strike the city with the edge of the sword." David flees in fear. There was a large contingent of men allied against him, with mutiny in their hearts. Other bystanders just watched brokenhearted and wept as David left. Verse 23 says, while the country was weeping with a loud voice, all of the people, David's people, passed over. The king passed over Brook Kidron, and all the people passed over by the way of the wilderness. David knew that Absalom would kill him in order to get his crown. And he walked by people who were weeping, but he knew that tears don't do anything in a battle but make your face wet. David, as a warrior, would certainly know that. Can you imagine the pain you would feel because your son wants to kill you for your position? The experience of betrayal that you would feel from the men that you had led into countless battles who are now going against you in mutiny. And then on top of all of that, to have a trusted friend involved in all of this would make it worse yet. The story says that as Absalom was rallying support to his cause, verse 12 of chapter 15 says that he sent for Ahithophel, the Gilonite, David's counselor, from his city where he was offering sacrifices. I don't know who your counselors or advisors are in your life, but I certainly don't have a multitude of them. A few men I've known for years and whom I trust. Most of them are friends. I know they will shoot straight with me, and I implicitly trust that they will never betray me. And Ahithophel was that man in David's life, a trusted counselor, an advisor whom David could go to and pour out his heart and receive good counsel back. He knew David's strengths. He knew David's weaknesses. He knew what made David tick. He knew what got him out of bed in the morning, what made him wish he was back there by noon. And Absalom summoned Ahithophel. How would Ahithophel respond? He was David's loyal friend. Of course he would tell Absalom to go take a flying leap, to change his heart's intent of killing his father and taking his crown. Of course he, as a wise advisor, would tell this younger man to bide his time and wait his rightful turn on the throne. Then in verse 30 of chapter 16 you read, "And David went up to the ascent of the Mount of Olives, and he wept as he went, and his head was covered, and he walked barefoot. Then all the people who were with him each covered his head and went up weeping as they went." And then someone told David, "Ahithophel is among the conspirators with Absalom." David's loyal friend, his confidant, his counselor, had betrayed him as well. And now here's David, pursued by a son who wants to kill him for his crown, being pursued by men he had led into battle before, who are now mutinying against him, and now even betrayed by a long-time trusted friend. How do you pray when that happens? How do you pray when your son wants you dead? When those you've led into battle and worked with betray you? When even your closest friend turns his back on you? Well, Psalm 55 is how David prayed, and I think we can learn some things from it. Perhaps even be some surprised by some things that he says as he prays. And so I would invite you to turn there with me now with this context and see how David prays. Psalm 55, we'll read the whole thing. I invite you to stand as we do. I won't make you sit down again, I promise. "Give ear to my prayer, O God, and do not hide yourself from my supplication. Give heed to me and answer me. I am restless in my complaint and am surely distracted. because of the voice of the enemy, because of the pressure of the wicked, for they bring down trouble upon me, and in anger they bear a grudge against me. My heart is in anguish within me, and the terrors of death have fallen upon me. Fear and trembling come upon me, and horror has overwhelmed me. I said, oh, that I had wings like a dove, if I would fly away and be at rest. Behold, I would wander far away, would lodge in the darkness, or in the wilderness, I'm sorry. I would hasten to my place of refuge from the stormy wind and tempest. Confuse, O Lord, divide their tongues, for I've seen violence and strife in the city. Day and night they go around upon her walls, and iniquity and mischief are in their midst. Destruction is in their midst. Oppression and deceit do not depart from her streets. For it is not an enemy who reproaches me, because then I could bear it. Nor is it one who hates me, who has exalted himself against me, then I could hide myself from him. But it is you, a man my equal, my companion and familiar friend. We who had sweet fellowship together walked in the house of God in the throng. Let death come deceitfully upon them. Let them go down alive to Sheol, for evil is in their dwelling, in their midst. As for me, I shall call upon the Lord, and the Lord will save me. Evening and morning and at noon, I will complain and murmur, and he will hear my voice. He will redeem my soul in peace from the battle which is against me, for they are many who strive with me, and God will hear them, even the one who sits enthroned from of old, with whom there is no change, and who do not fear God. He has put forth his hands against those who were at peace with him. He has violated his covenant. His speech was smoother than butter, but his heart was war. His words were softer than oil, yet they were drawn swords. Cast your burden upon the Lord, and he will sustain you. He will never allow the righteous to be shaken. But you, O God, will bring them down to the pit of destruction. Men of bloodshed and deceit will not live out half their days. But I will trust in you. This is the word of God. I think that from this prayer that we can see three components of a prayer that we can offer up if we are attacked or betrayed. In order to see them, we first off need to think about how this sort of anguish is commonly displayed and expressed. When you have just received word that your son wants you dead, you don't go to your desk and write haiku poetry about it, right? When your best friend has just betrayed you, you don't go, wow, what a perfect time for a limerick. What a great time to do that. No, if you have ever sat with someone whose son has just said he hates him, with a woman whose husband has just cheated on her, then you know that the words and the emotions, they just spill out. The emotion is raw, the words are strong, there is no linear thought to the expression. The phrases are often broken and lacking in artful beauty. Their thoughts go everywhere, often repeatedly. That's what David's poem does here. It goes all over the place as he prays to God. So because of the shotgun nature of what David says, what I've tried to do is to look for themes in what he said by gathering all of the shotgun pellets and putting them in piles where they seem to all fit, so that we can see what David is doing as he is pouring out this prayer. And what I find is three ways that we can pray when we are attacked or betrayed. The first part of David's prayer is a description of the situation to God, just an honest and thorough description of what is going on. He describes the situation to God in two ways. He tells God what he is thinking and feeling, what is going on inside of him. pours out on paper. Last part of verse 2, he says, I am restless in my complaint and surely distracted. I can't sit still. I can't concentrate on anything because of this. Verse 4, my heart is in anguish within me, and the terrors of death have fallen upon me, and the horror has overwhelmed me. God, I cannot only not concentrate, but I am afraid. I'm horrified that this is going to kill me. In fact, I'm so afraid that I just want to run away and hide. I just want to get away from the fear of it all. And you see this in verses 6 to 8 where he says, you know what, if I had wings like a dove, I would fly away and be at rest. I would wander far away and lodge in the wilderness, like where no one can find me. I would hasten to a place of refuge away from stormy wind and tempest. I just want to run. David is admitting to God what he is thinking and feeling. God, I can't concentrate anymore. I'm scared to death by what is going on, and I'd rather just run away and hide than stay the course and endure. David is so honest and transparent before God that he even expresses out loud his wishes for his enemy's harm. Verse 15, let death come deceitfully upon them. Let them go down alive to Sheol. For evil is in their dwelling in their midst. God, I can't concentrate anymore. I'm scared to death. I want to run and hide, and deep down, I want them dead. It's quite a prayer, isn't it? But it shows us something about prayer that we sometimes ignore, and it is this. That the deepest prayer is most often not polished, but primal. David prays from his guts, and he does not edit his words. And interestingly enough, there is no indication that God was disgusted with him for it. Now, I know when you look in the New Testament, you see Jesus telling us that we are to pray for our enemies and do good for those who persecute us. But I don't think that this eliminates our ability to pray what we are really feeling. But rather, it shows us that this sort of primal prayer for vengeance is not the right ending place of prayer, but it may be an adequate and common starting place for prayer. You don't want to stay there, but you may have to start there. As David describes his situation to God and tells him what's going on inside, he pours out emotions. Perhaps we don't like to express how we are feeling to anyone, let alone God. We stuff the emotions down, perhaps thinking that that's what real men do. I would beg to differ. The Bible would scream to differ. Moses cried aloud to God at how he was feeling and hurting. Joshua cried to God, cry of emotion. Jeremiah cried out to God. Elijah cried out to God and told him how he was feeling. Jesus cried out to his Father and told him how he was feeling. But out of a misguided sort of a stoicism, we think it's best to stuff it down. The biblical precedent shows us that it is not only okay, but may in fact be personally helpful to tell God how you're feeling. When you're being attacked and betrayed, David shows us that we need to understand what we are feeling and express that in the presence of God. As he describes what's going on inside of himself, he not only describes what he was feeling, he describes what his enemies were doing. He does so in a general sense in terms of plural enemy, where he uses the words like they, them. For example, I'll start reading in verse 1, but the key is verse 3. Give ear to my prayer, O God, and do not hide yourself from my supplication. Give heed to me and answer me. I am restless in my complaint and surely distracted. And here's why, verse 3, because of the voice of the enemy, very general, because of the pressure of the wicked, for they bring down trouble upon me, and in anger they bear a grudge against me. David is not specific except to say, there's a group of people who are talking against me, who are creating trouble against me, who are trying to settle some sort of grudge against me. David describes to God what people are generally doing against him. And then he talks about one individual in particular. Because as you go through the psalm, you see a change from they and them to he and him. And you would almost think that he's talking about Absalom. But he's not. He's talking about Ahithophel. Look at verse 12. For it's not an enemy who reproaches me. Then I could bear it. Nor is it one who hates me, who has exalted himself against me. Then I could hide myself from him. And then David goes on to refer to Ahithophel, but he does it in a really interesting way. Because in verse 13, he describes the situation to God. He is describing the situation to God, and it's like he breaks off to talk to Ahithophel, even though he is not there. It would be like this happening. If you asked your spouse or your roommate or your friend to bring home a liter of milk on their way home, and you phone them when they're almost home, and they say, oh, sorry, I forgot. And you hang up the phone, and then you say to your friend or to your spouse who cannot hear you, of course, you forgot the milk, because it's for me, not for you. If it was Cheetos or Doritos, you would have remembered. You don't care if I'm busy, you only care that you're busy, that's all that matters. I've been in the room, in the office, when that sort of thing has happened before, and you wonder, why on earth are you talking to a person who isn't even there while I am right here? That's what David does. He is so overcome with anguish that he breaks off talking to the God who is there, and he starts talking to Ahithophel who isn't there at all. He says this in verse 13, but it is you, a man my equal. That's not God. My companion and familiar or close friend. We had sweet fellowship together, walked in the house of God in the throng. We went to church together. We went for lunch afterwards. Our kids ran around the sanctuary, made the senior pastor mad. We carpooled. We served as elders together. We sang on the same worship team. We watched football together. We went on cross-border shopping excursions together. We hunted together. I had your back. You had my back. David became so emotionally involved in the hurt that he was feeling that he spoke to a guy who wasn't even there while he ignored the God who was. Now, sometimes we hesitate to tell God what is happening because he knows it, right? And so we don't really want to bore him with all of the redundant details of what he already knows. But I wonder where some of us might have got the idea that the purpose of prayer is to share new information with God, as if there is any. Instead, part of the purpose of sharing the information is to express it and to get it out of us before him. To stop it from spinning around like a vortex inside of us that just sucks into it all of our emotion and productive time and interpersonal energy till it's gone. Just get it out in front of God. Perhaps part of the purpose is even to re-experience it in the presence of God. God isn't informed by it, but you may be reformed by it. So the first way you can pray when people are out to get you, when you are betrayed by a friend, is to describe that situation to God. What happened? What you're feeling and thinking? Get it on the table in front of God, perhaps even repeatedly. There's a second component to the prayer that David offered when he was under attack and betrayed. In my elementary school, you were expected to fight if you were a boy. We knew that we would end up in James Fowler High School, so this was kind of the Spartan training for arriving there. And we soon learned that there were different fight experiences, much more refined than winning or losing in terms of description. For example, if you lost a fight badly, you got kicked. On the other hand, if you managed to win a fight without a bruise or a scratch, it was a not-a-scratch victory. And I achieved one of these that I recall, one among many, many. That wasn't funny, that was true. Grade 3, David the Weenie is what I called him. And he was bugging me, perhaps because he didn't like my name for him. We exchanged words and set the time and place of battle. Colonel Saunders Elementary School, down on the far side, away from the roving teacher who got stuck trying to watch the playground by the sandbox at recess. I would like to think it was my amazing skill. Perhaps it was. But I managed to get my leg behind him and push him over and jump on top of him and just start throwing punches. I just fed him until he was crying and squealing like a rabbit in distress. It was great. It was at the time, before I became a pacifist. It was a not-a-scratch victory. And I mean, the adrenaline's going, the pride's going, your friends are so happy about it, and it lasted until after school, because David the Weenie had enough time after I beat him to go and find his grade 6 brother, Tyrone the Meanie, let's call him. And after school, Tyrone thoroughly enjoyed a not-a-scratch victory at my expense, and I got kicked. You know what? What David the Weenie did with his big brother, Tyrone the Meanie, is exactly what David the King did with God in this psalm. Because he not only described his situation with God, he tried to rally God as the strong one to fight for him. He requested that God fight for him. For example, look at what he says in verse 9, "Confuse, O Lord, divide their tongues." His prayer is that God would confound his enemies by dividing them rather than conquering them, dividing their communication rather than having it understandable. It has an interesting similarity to the prayer that David prayed against Ahithophel when he found that he had betrayed him in 2 Samuel 16. When he had heard that he had been betrayed, he prayed in verse 31, "O Lord, I pray, make the counsel of Ahithophel foolishness." He said, "Lord, go after him. Confound their purposes by confusing their wisdom." And then look at verse 15 again. Powerful word in there. "Let death come deceitfully on them. Let them go down alive to Sheol. For evil is in their dwelling, in their midst. God, kill them. But make sure that they are alive enough, even though they are dead, that they suffer all the way down to that world of death and shadows. Avenge me, God." So the first way you can pray when those who attack and betray you is to describe the situation to God. The second way is to request that God fight for you. And there's a third part of this prayer. Much of this prayer is in the present tense. This is what is happening to me now. This is what I'm feeling right now. But in the conclusion of the psalm, David changes from his present hell to a future hope. Look at the future verb tenses, beginning in verse 16. As for me, I shall call upon the Lord, and the Lord will save me. Evening and morning and noon, I will complain and murmur, and he will hear my voice. He will redeem my soul in peace from the battle which is against me. And down to verse 22, cast your burden upon the Lord, and he will sustain you. He will never allow the righteous to be shaken. But thou, O Lord, will bring them, my enemies, down to the pit of destruction. Men of bloodshed and destruction will not live out half their days, but I will trust in you. What he is doing is that he is affirming his trust in God to deliver. You know, I can give you all of the ideas in the world as to how to pray, but unless you believe in David's God, you will never do so with hope. David says, I'm going to cry and plead and cry out day and night because I know God will hear me. I'm going to cry out to God because I know he is a redeeming God who saves. I am going to call out on God that he will sustain me, because he will. And I'm going to call on God because he is a just God, and evil men will get what is coming to them. How do we pray when we're attacked or betrayed? We describe to God what is going on because he cares. We solicit his help in defending us because he is just. And we affirm our hope in him to deliver because he saves. We describe what is going on to God because he cares. We solicit his help to defend us because he is just. We affirm our hope in him to deliver because he saves. You may not have known how to handle a situation or attack or a betrayal before, at least not in a Christian way, and so have been stuck, unmoved and mired ever since. It is ever before you and sours much of your life and sucks much of your joy. I would like to take the time for you to pray about it today, but there isn't enough time, not even because we're a bit over time, but because this is a road to walk, not a step to take. But now that you know the path down the road of response in prayer to attack and betrayal, I would strongly encourage you that if this has happened, if you have not dealt with it, to begin to do so this afternoon even in prayer. And know that God understands, that Jesus knows what it's like to be betrayed. He wants you to come, and he can bring about healing and justice. In advance of your private prayer, allow me to pray for you, and then Aaron will come up and lead us. Father, I want to thank you today that you are a God who hears our prayers and deals justly with us. Jesus, I want to thank you for modeling for us a prayer life that was dependent upon and vulnerable with your Father. Holy Spirit, I thank you that you bring divine comfort and intercede for us when we're at a loss of how to express what we're thinking and feeling inside. And it is because of who you are as our triune God that I feel confident in lifting up those here today who've been attacked or betrayed, and ask that you would minister to them in the quietness of this time, that you would bring comfort, healing, and hope to those who have suffered untold and at times inexpressible pain at the hands, from the mouths, and through the deeds of others against them. May your touch in their hearts right now give them the impetus to seek you later on and often. For I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.
Please stand.